Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio here in East County. Today, we have the latest on the worst mass shooting in U.S. history at a concert in Las Vegas, Nevada, including information on two vehicles being sought by authorities, details emerging on the shooter, the latest toll of victims, and where you can call if you're looking for information on missing loved ones in Vegas. From Sacramento, hear about a package of 15 affordable housing bills just signed into law by Governor Brown that aim to help the homeless and those with low incomes, but which have drawn opposition from some community and environmental groups for taking away local control. Today we'll also have a special report on the federal response to Hurricane Maria, which has devastated the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. Hear why critics are faulting the Trump administration for a slower response to help survivors of this hurricane than to Hurricanes Harvey and Irma victims in Texas and Florida. The U.S. Forest Service is warning that more than half its budget is being consumed by fighting wildfires, leaving inadequate funds for other priorities, including fire prevention. Locally, however, we have some good news on fire safety thanks to a grant from SDG&E to purchase firefighting equipment for local firefighters. Residents in rural Campo are complaining that they've been dissed by Dish TV, which has cut out the only station on which they can view some of the most popular national television programs. We'll have details on the dumping of CW San Diego by Dish TV on today's show. On Crime Beat, hear about a man shot in the head in La Mesa during broad daylight on Sunday afternoon. Then, we'll have a heads up for motorists about lane closures on Highway 67 three nights this week in Ramona. The county kicked off its flu vaccination program this last weekend, and we'll have details on where you can get your flu shot on today's show. On our sports report, Liz Alper has the latest news to cheer about from the Aztecs. Next up, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes, an interview with author Diana Lindsay about her guidebook, Coast to Cactus. Plus, we'll have news about a bill to protect the San Diego River Park Corridor signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown, a bill that was supported by all local legislators except one, who has taken hefty contributions from developers. Find out who on today's show. We'll have all these stories and more on today's episode of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The worst mass shooting in U.S. history occurred late Sunday night in Las Vegas, where at least 58 people have died and over 515 victims were transported to hospitals with injuries. The death toll will likely climb even higher. Sheriff Joseph Lombardo stated Monday, "We still have a long way to go in body recovery." The slaughter occurred at a Route 91 Country Music Harvest concert on the Vegas Strip across the street from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. The shooter is reported to have fired out a window on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay, with gunfire lasting as long as 15 minutes, some witnesses have told media. Audio tapes suggest that he fired a fully automatic weapon, which is not legal to own. The shooter, who authorities say killed himself as police closed in on his hotel room, has been identified as 64-year-old Stephen Paddock. He was a white resident of Mesquite, Nevada, an accountant, and a regular gambler who has frequented Vegas casinos. Interestingly, his father was a bank robber listed on the FBI's most wanted list until he was apprehended and sentenced to 20 years in prison. Multiple guns, including 10 assault rifles, were found in Stephen Paddock's hotel room at the Mandalay. The British newspaper The Independent reports that ISIS claimed credit for the attack. However, FBI Special Agent Aaron Rouse, the agent in charge of the FBI in Vegas, disputes that claim. In a press conference, he states, "We have determined to this point no connection with an international terrorist group." Authorities have been searching for an Asian woman named Marilou Danley, described as Paddock's companion, though police do not believe she was involved in the shooting. There are reports this afternoon that they have located her. Two vehicles, both registered in Nevada, are being sought by authorities. The first is a Hyundai Tucson, license 114B40. The second is a Chrysler Pacifica, license 19D401. The deadly shooting caused panic among over 22,000 concertgoers as they struggled to identify where the shots were coming from and flee the scene. The mass shooting led to shutdown of the Vegas Strip and a freeway nearby. Rumors of other hotels targeted and of explosive threats proved unfounded, police later said. Singer Jason Aldean was performing when the gunman opened fire, and this is what it sounded like. Aldean fled the stage and later tweeted that his crew was safe. But he wrote, "My thoughts and prayers go out to everyone involved tonight. It hurts my heart that this would happen to anyone who was just coming out to enjoy what should have been a fun night." Among the dead are two off-duty Las Vegas police officers who were in the audience. Two other officers were injured, one seriously. San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman has confirmed that two San Diego police officers were also in the crowd but were not injured. President Donald Trump has ordered flags flown at half-mast. He called for prayers for victims and their families in his speech Monday morning, adding, "We call upon the bonds of citizenship, the ties of community, and the comfort of our common humanity. Our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence," the president said. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump will visit Las Vegas on Wednesday. The massacre is reigniting debate over gun control, with some congressional Democrats and Hillary Clinton calling for limits on access to such weapons by private citizens. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress are expected to take up a bill this week that would legalize silencers, as the National Rifle Association is advocating. Although silencers only mute, not completely block, the sounds of gunfire, in a noisy concert venue, even a few decibels could prevent some from hearing gunfire and taking cover. The difference between life or death in scenarios such as the Las Vegas massacre. The FBI is asking that anyone with videos or photos from the shooting please call 800-225-5324. And if you are looking for a missing loved one in Las Vegas, you can call that same number at 800-225-5324. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law 15 bills that aim to ease the state's affordable housing crisis, but which also restrict the abilities of local governments, environmentalists, and neighborhood groups to block projects in their communities. In a signing statement, the governor said, "These new laws will help cut red tape and encourage more affordable housing, including shelter for the growing number of homeless in California." Here's what the new laws will do. State Senator Tony Atkins, a San Diego Democrat, authored State Bill 2, which aims to reduce homelessness by raising $250 to $300 million a year to fund affordable housing development programs and long-range development planning at the local level. The funds will come from a new fee on certain real estate transactions and can be spent on rental assistance, development of housing for the homeless, and homeless navigation centers. Another measure, Senate Bill 3, would put a $4 billion housing bond on the ballot to fund the CalVet home loan program for veterans, pay for low-income housing projects, and fund residential construction near jobs and public transit. Senate Bill 35 would force cities and counties that haven't built enough housing for all income levels to let developers avoid costly environmental reviews and public hearings, also limits the public input on new projects in their communities. Yet, conversely, it also mandates higher pay for construction workers on projects with 10 units or more. Senate Bill 166 mandates that local government identify development sites for all unmet housing needs, from very low income to higher market rates. It also strengthens state housing law that generally prevents local jurisdictions from reducing zoning densities. Two bills, Senate Bill 167 and Assembly Bill 678 beef up the Housing Accountability Act by making it harder for communities to block proposed housing projects or homeless shelters. The new laws would authorize courts to fine cities or counties that don't comply, aiming to limit influence by neighbors, environmentalists, or others seeking to limit development. Senate Bill 540 allows communities to establish pre-planned zones for affordable housing to boost development in urban centers near transit and jobs. Projects in these zones must sell or rent 30% of units to moderate-income households, 15% to low-income, and 5% to very low-income households. In addition, 10% of market-rate projects would be set aside for those with low incomes. Similarly, Assembly Bill 73 lets cities and counties designate housing sustainability districts to streamline new housing construction near transit corridors. The bill fast-tracks lawsuits challenging environmental review and requires that 20% of housing in a district be affordable to low-income residents. Under Assembly Bill 72, state housing officials will have expanded authority to report violations to the Attorney General if local governments are not complying with their own housing plans or if their actions violate state law. Assembly Bill 571 expands California's low-income tax credit program, which helps fund low-income housing development, to include housing for farm workers. Assembly Bill 879 requires cities and counties to remove hurdles to housing production, such as by reducing how long it takes from approval of a housing project to getting construction permits. Assembly Bill 1397 requires the parcels zoned for housing development must have access to sufficient infrastructure for water, sewer, and other public utilities. Assembly Bill 1505 allows local jurisdictions to require that at least 15% of units in market-rate residential developments be set aside as affordable housing. Assembly Bill 1515 makes it harder for local governments to turn down housing projects or emergency shelters if they meet existing zoning and other land use regulations, and makes it more difficult for community groups to stop such projects. Assembly Bill 1521 aims to prevent loss of affordable units by requiring public notification before low-income housing protections expire and units can be converted to market rate. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Valerie Watts.
Nearly 2 weeks after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory, a military hospital ship has not yet arrived while the death toll continues to mount. So has criticism of the Trump administration's response to the disaster, in stark contrast to two earlier hurricanes in Texas and Florida. Only 10,000 National Guard members have been deployed, compared to 31,000 swiftly sent after Hurricanes Irma and Harvey struck Florida and Texas. There are also far fewer FEMA personnel, CNN reports. Around 3.6 million American citizens live on the island, many trapped and running out of food and water. Roads and electric infrastructure are largely destroyed. Power remains off for 95% of the island, including many hospitals. Electricity is expected to be out for months in some areas. At least 33 people have died, including some insulin-dependent diabetics who could not keep their life-saving medications refrigerated, NPR reports. Puerto Rican authorities say the number of dead will likely climb into the hundreds or more as access is gained to remote areas where communications have been cut off and people have been left without access to food or clean water. President Donald Trump blocked foreign ships from bringing aid or helping with evacuations until 9 days after the Category 5 hurricane hit Puerto Rico. He finally waived the Jones Act under pressure from the public, media, and some members of Congress, the Washington Post reports. By contrast, Trump waived the Jones Act immediately for Hurricanes Irma and Harvey. The Jones Act, part of the 1920 Merchant Marine Act, prohibits any vessel not owned, built, or partly crewed by the U.S. or its citizens from transporting cargo between points within the United States, leaving Puerto Rico on their own. Several days ago, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz pleaded for help after Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke told CNN, "I know it is really a good news story in terms of our ability to reach people," adding she was very satisfied with the federal response. The San Juan mayor fired back, "This is not a good news story. This is a people are dying story. This is a life or death story." She added that trucks could not get through on blocked or damaged roads to even deliver vital supplies. Trump lashed out angrily on Twitter, tweeting, "Such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico who are not able to get their workers to help. They want everything to be done for them when it should be a community effort." Trump tweeted his insults while he was vacationing at a golf resort in New Jersey. His staggering callousness amid the catastrophic disaster drew swift and strong criticisms. A photo making the rounds on Twitter shows San Juan's mayor wading out chest-deep to aid a man in a kayak on a flooded street. Denise Froman, author of the tweet, wrote, "To be clear, this is the mayor of San Juan who he insulted. She's using a bullhorn to find people," as the picture clearly showed. Russell Honore, the retired general appointed by Republican President George W. Bush to take over the federal response to Hurricane Katrina after an initial bungled response cost many lives in New Orleans back in 2005, told CNN last week that President Trump, quote, "has shown again that he doesn't give a damn about poor people. He doesn't give a damn about people of color." Lin-Manuel Miranda, creator of the hit musical Hamilton, is of Puerto Rican descent. He tweeted, "You're going straight to hell, Donald Trump." Miranda, in an article published in The Hollywood Reporter, also wrote poignantly about the plight of his own family in Puerto Rico after the hurricane damaged their homes, left them stranded without adequate supplies, and put his sister's plan to take a medical school admission test on hold indefinitely. Republican Senator John McCain and Republican Representative Don Santis of Florida joined with Democrats in urging the president to waive the Jones Act finally. McCain, who has sought to repeal the Jones Act, called it unacceptable to force Puerto Ricans to pay, quote, twice as much for food, clean drinking water, supplies, and infrastructure in the wake of Hurricane Maria. Democratic Senator Ed Markey tweeted, "First thing Trump should do on Tuesday when he visits Puerto Rico for the first time since Hurricane Maria devastated the island is apologize." Belatedly, more relief efforts are underway now by the federal government, as well as from non-governmental sources. Royal Caribbean canceled a cruise in order to send its cruise ship to Puerto Rico and evacuate some 3,000 people off the island. All five living ex-presidents have joined together to work toward relief for Puerto Rico: Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Jimmy Carter. Their appeal states, "Americans always answer the call." You can donate to help the people of Puerto Rico through their bipartisan relief effort at oneamericaappeal.org. Again, that's oneamericaappeal.org. The response by the ex-presidents, setting political differences aside to show leadership during a national disaster, stands in stark contrast to the current White House occupant, who scarcely even mentioned Puerto Rico days after the hurricane's 160-mile-an-hour winds wreaked havoc. And yet, he found time to tweet criticisms of NFL football players who knelt during the national anthem, silently protesting racism in the United States. Racism that to many seems apparent and abhorrent in President Trump's unequal response to hurricane victims in Puerto Rico, an island of Hispanic Americans, compared to U.S. responses to hurricanes in solidly Republican states, Texas and Florida. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
The U.S. Forest Service, in a series of messages sent on its Twitter account, warns that the growing cost of wildfires is taking money from other programs, including those that reduce fire threats. This year, the Federal Forest Service expects to transfer $500 to $600 million from other accounts to fund firefighting. That means less money to support hazardous fuel reduction, reforestation, recreation, watershed, timber, and wildlife conservation, says Vicki Christensen, Forest Service's deputy chief. She blames this shift not only on growing wildfires, but also on the erosion of the agency's non-fire budget. In 1995, wildfires accounted for 16% of the agency's budget. This year, fighting fires has taken 56%, more than half, of all U.S. Forest Service resources. As conditions worsen across the West, wildfires are projected to consume two-thirds of the agency's overall budget by 2021, 4 years from now. The agency warns, "Our mission is to sustain America's forests and grasslands, but it's consumed by the growing cost of wildfires." That challenge comes amid budget slashing to federal agencies by the Trump administration and increasingly hot, dry temperatures fueled by climate change, scientists report, And yet President Trump refuses to acknowledge the existence of climate change, let alone take steps to slow climate change or expend funds to address the impacts, such as more frequent and severe firestorms. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
San Diego Gas and Electric has announced a $100,000 grant to purchase essential equipment and medical apparatus for San Diego County Fire and rural fire agencies to better serve local communities and protect the region from future fires. Working with the San Diego Regional Fire Foundation, the funds are set to provide new state-of-the-art equipment to San Diego County Fire and the fire agencies in Alpine, Julian, and Borrego Springs, including upgraded radios, breathing apparatus, medical equipment, mobile computers on fire engines, and education on defensible space. David Gare, a senior vice president at San Diego Gas and Electric, states, "By collaborating with fire agencies to help provide critical equipment they need and continuing to improve our electric system, we are making our region more prepared today than it was yesterday." San Diego County Fire Chief Tony Meacham says, "In San Diego County, we live with the year-round threat of wildfires, so these donations are instrumental to our brothers and sisters who respond to calls every day. Know that collaborations like this are truly making an impact when we can measurably reduce response times and fire damage to private properties." To date, San Diego Gas and Electric has donated nearly $1 million through its Safe San Diego initiative. Since the 2007 firestorms, when some SDG&E power lines, along with Cox cable equipment, were found by CAL FIRE to have sparked fires during high winds, SDG&E has worked to upgrade the power system to ensure it can endure the most extreme conditions. Some of those improvements include bringing back the air crane for the 8th year to help stop fires before homes and businesses are damaged, modernizing over 10,000 wooden power poles with fire-resistant steel ones in fire-prone areas so customers don't lose power when they need it the most, sharing data from the largest utility-owned weather network, complete with infrared cameras so fire agencies can make informed staffing decisions on fire threat zones, and providing fire agencies with the daily fire potential and Santa Ana wildfire threat rating to ensure San Diegans are better protected in an emergency. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Backcountry residents in San Diego's East County are baffled as to why, after they signed up for Dish TV satellite service, Dish has inexplicably dropped carrying CW San Diego programming. Billy Joe Jannon, a Dish subscriber and chair of the Campo Lake Morena Community Planning Group, says rural residents in her community can't watch the new fall lineup, including Supernatural, one of the all-time blockbusters in TV series popularity. She adds that Dish still charges us the same for local channels, even after dropping CW San Diego. But rural residents here rely on satellite and don't have other options, since they have no access to cable or broadband. CW San Diego, along with the KFMB-CBS affiliate in San Diego, are owned by Midwest Television. KFMB programming and marketing manager Judy Albrecht told Jannon in an email that the decision to drop the local CW station was made by Dish, adding, "We have requested they carry us, and we are not asking for any compensation." She states that Dish is the only cable satellite distributor that is not carrying the CW San Diego. But according to Jannon, Ryan Vogler with Dish TV said CW San Diego only offered Dish free airing for a limited time, after which a hefty fee would be charged. We contacted Vogler for confirmation, and he referred us to Courtney Culpepper. Culpepper blamed CW for the station not being available on Dish's lineup, stating, "Local affiliate stations like the CW in San Diego retain the exclusive rights to distribute network or syndicated programming within a given market." She adds that due to the station's in-market monopoly, Dish can substitute an out-of-market station or national feed to bring popular national CW programs to Dish's viewers here. KFMB President and General Manager Alberto Mier y Terán disputed Culpepper's claims. He says, "We want Dish to carry our CW station. We offered Dish the right to carry. We gave them transmission consent without any compensation, and they chose not to do it." asked if it was true that the free offer was only short-term and that higher fees would be charged to DISH to carry CW San Diego long-term, the KFMB president told us, "I would say that's untrue." He clarified that with over a year left on an existing deal with DISH to carry KFMB, we wanted to add the CW station for the agreement. They chose not to do that. KFMB's president does offer hope for dissed DISH TV users, however, saying negotiations will continue when the deal comes up for renewal, and he hopes CW San Diego may eventually be added back into DISH's TV local lineup. Janin voices frustration over the company's failure to cut a deal in time to let local rural residents view the fall TV lineup. "In the meantime," she complains, "the new seasons of Vampire Diaries and Supernatural have started without us." Potential subscribers to DISH TV may wish to keep in mind the company's bait-and-switch tactic, offering and then taking away popular programming. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Valerie Watts.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A La Mesa resident shot a man in the head at Glen and Mariposa Streets Sunday afternoon, just above the La Mesa downtown village where the city's Oktoberfest was being held. The location is also close to State Route 125 and the Lemon Avenue Elementary School. La Mesa police arrived around 4:45 in the afternoon to find the wounded man lying in the street. He was transported to a hospital in very, very serious condition, says Lieutenant Chad Bell. The man was reportedly known to the shooter, but they were not related. Detectives are investigating the motive. The shooter was detained for questioning but has not been arrested as of our show's taping deadline on Monday.
This is Valerie Watts with an alert for motorists. Caltrans has announced lane closures on State Route 67 at Dye Road and Highland Valley Road on Monday, and again this Wednesday and Thursday night from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. each night. The closures are for safety upgrades and lane striping. One lane in each direction will remain open during the road work, but expect some traffic slowing if you are traveling in this area. You can sign up to receive free East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts at eastcountymagazine.org and follow East County Alert on Twitter.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Valerie Watts with a health report. Nearly 100 people got immunized last Friday during a clinic launched by County Health and Human Services Agency to kick off this year's flu vaccination campaign. This is the 14th year in a row the county has worked with the San Diego Black Nurses Association to vaccinate people in San Diego's southeastern community at no cost. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says it's great to see people getting vaccinated before the flu starts to spread. Dr. Wooten got her own flu shot during the vaccination event. She says the vaccine is safe and effective and urges everyone to get vaccinated to avoid getting sick and spreading the virus to others. Last season, 87 people in the San Diego region died from complications from the flu, 19 more than the previous season. 97 people died during the 2014-15 flu season, the highest total since county began tracking flu deaths nearly 20 years ago. Persons with pre-existing medical conditions are more likely to experience serious complications from influenza, but healthy people could unexpectedly have severe illness that leads to disability or even death. People may be contagious for a full day before they start to feel symptoms, and as a result, spread the disease to vulnerable family members. Severa Hardy, who organizes vaccination events for the San Diego Black Nurses Association, says they're bringing the vaccine to the elderly so that they can get the flu shot for free, adding, "It's very important that they get vaccinated so that they don't get sick." The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone 6 months and older get a flu shot every year. It takes 2 weeks for immunity to develop. This season's flu vaccine offers protection against several strains of the flu. Vaccination is especially important for people who are at high risk of developing serious complications from influenza. They include people aged 65 and older, pregnant women, persons with chronic medical conditions such as asthma, diabetes, and lung disease, and those who live with or care for others at high risk. In addition to getting vaccinated, people should also wash hands thoroughly and often, use hand sanitizers, stay away from sick people, clean commonly touched surfaces, avoiding touching your eyes, nose, and mouth, and if you are sick, stay home and avoid contact with others. The flu vaccine is available at doctor's offices and retail pharmacies. If you don't have medical insurance, you can get a flu shot at a community health center or a county public health center. For a list of locations, visit sdiz.org or call 211.
Spring Valley will soon be getting a new public park. Spring Valley residents are invited to a meeting to provide input on future amenities for the Ildica Street County Park. You can join staff from the Department of Parks and Recreation to provide your ideas for developing this just over half-acre parcel. The meeting will be held on Wednesday, October 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Spring Valley branch of the County Library on Kempton Street. Laura Lowes, Spring Valley Community Planning Group member, says this is our opportunity to give input to the county on our needs for a park at this site. Inform your friends and neighbors of the meeting, she asks. Reporting in Spring Valley for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Valerie Watts with an education report. Grossmont Union High School District seeks applicants to fill two vacancies on its Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. The committee oversees the implementation of school bond measures Proposition U and Measure BB. The appointee will serve a two-year term beginning January 2018 as a community member at large and will be eligible to serve for up to two additional two-year terms. Members must be at least 18 years old, cannot be an employee of the district or a contractor, vendor, or consultant to the district. They must be able to attend meetings held the last Wednesday evening in January, March, June, and September, as well as serve on a subcommittee that meets quarterly. Applications and details must be received by November 1st and can be obtained on the district's website.
This is Liz Alper with the Aztecs football report. Number 19 and 21 San Diego State moved to 5-0 for the first time since 1975 after earning a hard-fought 34-28 triumph over Northern Illinois Saturday night in front of more than 35,000 fans at SDCCU Stadium. Despite getting Elkane 429-263 yards, including a 269-136 yard spread in passing yardage, the Aztecs converted two Husky turnovers into 14 points before coming up with two crucial interceptions late in the fourth quarter to help secure the team's seventh consecutive victory dating back to last year. Rashad Penny was bottled up for much of the first half, but still gained 107 yards on 25 carries, becoming the first Aztec running back since Marshall Faulk in 1992 to open the season with five straight games over 100 yards rushing. In addition, Kristen Chapman completed 10 of 19 passes for 136 yards and two touchdowns, finishing his third straight game without an interception, while tight end Kahale Warren posted three catches for 39 yards and one score. Juwan Washington electrified the crowd on the opening kickoff return, racing 96 yards through tacklers for a touchdown to give SDSU an early 7-0 lead. However, NIU quickly responded with a 7-play, 73-yard drive culminating in a 34-yard scoring strike from quarterback Daniel Santa Catarina to wide receiver Kristen Blake down the right sideline. The Aztecs were limited to a 3-and-out on their ensuing possession, but on the first play after the punt, reserve linebacker Andrew Alecki alertly pounced on a loose ball at the Husky 33-yard line after a fumble by NIU running back Andrew Parchman. SDSU wasted little time capitalizing on its good fortune as Chapman hit Penny in the right corner of the end zone on the very next snap, putting the host school up 14-7 with just over 5 minutes elapsed in the period. However, the Huskies answered with another long drive, marching 77 yards in 13 plays to even the score at 14-14. Santa Catarina connected with Blake 6 times for 44 yards on the possession, including the final 10 for the tying touchdown. NIU seemed poised to take the lead early in the second quarter, advancing 71 yards in 10 plays to the SDSU 20. However, on 2nd and 4, safety Tariq Thompson stepped in front of a Santa Catarina slant pass and returned it 83 yards for the go-ahead score. With the turnover, SDSU recorded its 6th interception return for a touchdown in the last 17 games. After a Husky punt, the Aztecs finally managed their longest sustained drive of the night, as Chapman found a wide-open Warren in the end zone from 8 yards out to cap a 7-play, 66-yard march with just 2:12 remaining in the first half. Just 2 plays earlier, the SDSU duo hooked up for a 21-yard gain on a 3rd and 8 to keep the drive alive. With time winding down, SDSU got the ball back following another punt and swiftly marched into NIU territory. On 4th and 1 from the Husky 44, Penny scampered 23 yards to help set up John Barron's 38-yard field goal with just 7 seconds left, which gave the Aztecs a 31-14 advantage at intermission. As quickly as SDSU scored in the first quarter, NIU flashed its big play capability on the second snap of the third period, when Santa Catarina found a streaking Spencer Fierce who darted down the sideline in full stride for an 81-yard touchdown reception, which narrowed the gap to 31-21. Later in the period, the Huskies trimmed the margin to 31-28, as reserve quarterback Marcus Childers scored on a keeper from 1 yard out to punctuate a 4-play, 60-yard drive. The two teams traded possessions before the Aztecs tacked on the key 21-yard field goal by Barron, with 45 seconds elapsed in the fourth quarter to extend the margin to 34-28. After Penny got SDSU out of the hole with a 25-yard sweep down the right sideline, Chapman hit Colin Andrews for an 11-yard gain, while Washington soon followed with an 11-yard burst to put Barron in range for a chip shot. Later in the period, the Aztecs punted from deep within their own territory on 2 occasions, giving NIU the edge in field position. Following the second exchange, the Huskies went for broke on the 1st and 10 play from the SDSU 20. However, Cameron Kelly extinguished the threat with an interception at the 1 yard line. A personal foul penalty on Kelly's 44-yard return placed the ball back at the 30 with 2:28 left in the game, but SDSU was unable to gain the first down and promptly punted to the Husky 15. 3 plays later, Thompson came up huge with his 2nd interception of Santa Catarina at the NIU 20 with just 1:42 to go. In addition to Thompson's heroics, Parker Baldwin posted a team-high 11 tackles, while Kelly finished with 9 stops of his own, including 7 solo efforts. The Aztec defense also received a boost from Jay Henderson, who contributed 4 tackles for loss, including a career-best 3 sacks. With the victory, SDSU improved to 26-3 over its last 29 games, which was the 3rd-best record in the country during that span. The Aztecs return to Mountain West play at UNLV next Saturday at 7:45 p.m. The game will be televised on ESPN2.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Diana Lindsay. My guest is president of Sunbelt Publications and leading editor of the book Coast to Cactus, The Canyoneer Trail Guide to San Diego Outdoors. Coast to Cactus, which was published by Sunbelt in partnership with the San Diego Natural History Museum, contains 245 outings and 73 extension hikes. Welcome, Diana. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the book. I know that it's based on the weekly Romo-Rama column for the San Diego Reader, and it's the field guide to the Natural History Museum's exhibition, Coast to Cactus, Southern California. But summarize, if you will, what readers will find in Coast to Cactus that they may not find elsewhere. How is it unique?
Well, first of all, it's more than a hiking guide. It is also a field guide. So unlike having to take your hiking guide out into an area that you want to explore along with many trail guides for flowers, for birds, for amphibians or reptiles, you can just take this one book, because what it does do is function as a field guide. There's 525 different species that are found in San Diego County that are featured, that have photos in them, that have full descriptions. So this is just the one book that you need to be able to study and learn about the county as you're hiking on a trail.
So that makes it much more practical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's such a wonderfully colorful book.
Yeah, it has 665 color photos in it. It has 258 maps. It also features the habitats that you will find within the county. We're using the system that San Diego State University has on 9 different habitats that are found in San Diego County. And each of the maps has a symbol by it telling you what habitat you will encounter on that hike. So in some hikes, for instance, you may just have a chaparral or a riparian area. So there'll be the symbols for those two habitats next to the map, and you'll know you will encounter that on the hike. But another hike may have 5 or 6 different types of habitats that you will encounter as you are on the trail. So we're trying to teach people to become aware of when they hike, you know, what types of habitats they actually will encounter on those hikes.
That's wonderful. And can you also explain the map in the beginning of the book with the chapters for depending on which region?
We have a map in the front of the book, and we decided not to use a grid system that many hiking books do use. We wanted to make it easier for the readers so we have broken up the chapters according to logical areas that are geographical boundaries by freeways. So you can look at an area that's encompassed by, let's say, Interstate 15 or 5 and cross freeways that go, and you can go into that chapter and you will find all the hikes that are within that area. We have the overall breakdown of the book broken into the coastal hikes, the inland hikes, which are the foothills. We have the mountain hikes and the desert hikes. So those are the 4 regions that we cover within the book. And then within each of those regions, we break it down into geographical areas to make it easier for people to find those particular places that they want to explore.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So much to discover.
Yes.
Now, I understand that your company envisioned a hiking guide to the county, but then Jerry Schad's A Foot in a Field was published by Wilderness Press in 1986. How did that desire lead you to the production of Coast to Cactus?
Well, my husband and I wrote the guidebook for the Anza-Borrego Desert region in 1978, and then we had thought beyond that, thinking that what was really needed was a guide to the entire county. Meanwhile, Jerry had been working on the county guide, and he came out with his book. It's a very excellent book. And so that kind of put our desires to do a county book on a shelf, but always we had that in the back of our minds. You know, if we were going to do a book, how could we do it that would be different than what Jerry did, that people would be interested in? And at the time, you know, we wanted to learn more about the county and the things that we could see on the trail. And that's when we joined the San Diego Natural History Museum and became canyoneers almost 30 years ago. And to learn about the species and the plants and the habitats that are found on trails. And from that experience, the idea evolved that, well, what if we took this experiences of knowing the species and the habitats and actually integrated it within a guidebook, would that be something that people would be interested in? And would it actually lead to really learning about the county and helping to understand what is actually found in our county?
How long did it take to put this together? It sounds like an enormous project.
Well, we introduced I introduced the idea of working on a book such as this about a decade ago, and it seemed like an overwhelming project. So it kind of sat on a back shelf for many, many years, and actually what happened, Jerry unfortunately had passed away, and I was at his memorial service, and the publisher of the San Diego Reader, Jim Holman, had said that they were looking for somebody to take over the Romo-Rama column, which Jerry had written very wonderful columns throughout the years.
Right.
So I went back to the Canyoneers and I said, you know, we have an opportunity here to actually do this book, and it would be more manageable because all we would have to do is do one article a week until we had enough articles to put it together in a book. And so that's when we made an agreement with my publishing house, the mm-hmm. San Diego Natural History Museum, and the Canyoneers to work on this. And then we began the columns, a weekly column for the San Diego Reader. After several years, we had enough to do a book, and then the real work began. So then right. It was about 18 months, 2 years, to then basically strip all of the descriptions, pull it back, check all the descriptions for the trails to make sure they're accurate, and then to reinsert the descriptions, but not repeating them, only doing one particular detailed description in the book for every species that we wanted to cover. The difficulty here was to make sure that when we did put a species description in, that it was actually found on that trail and that the description was accurate. So we had to have all the curators with their specialties check everything we wrote. We had to work with all of the agencies where the trails were found and then run the trail descriptions by them to make sure they were accurate. They checked our trails. And so we made sure that not only were the species descriptions correct, that the habitats mm-hmm. that we said were there were correct, but that all of the information regarding those species were correct. And then, and so that was a long project. Yeah, we had two other editors besides myself that worked very closely together. So we made sure that all the descriptions were accurate, and then we went back and forth and double checked everything.
It really sounds like a labor of love.
Well, actually, it was a labor of love because unlike most books where an author has the royalty and they make money from this book, everybody that worked on this book, all the Canyoneers, and there's over 50 people who made contributions to the Roma-Rama articles that we used, and the editors, myself and Paula Noel and Terry Barnell, all of us are volunteers at the San Diego Natural History Museum. So all our work was as a volunteer for the museum, and all the proceeds from the book that a normal author would receive are going to the museum. So when anybody buys Wonderful. This book, they're actually supporting the San Diego Natural History Museum.
That's nice to know. Talk a little bit more about the Canyoneers and this exhibit at the museum.
Yes, the Canyoneers are it's a program at the museum that's over 40 years old, and it was started by a botanist, Helen Shamley, at the museum. There was a canyon next to the museum, still there, mm-hmm. a Florida canyon, which was very lovely canyon. In several years later, after the Canyoneers began, there was a fire there, and that's what resulted in the Canyoneers actually moving out into the county. But the original idea was to have docents that were trained by the museum curators to take the public into the Florida Canyon. They were called the Florida Canyoneers, and to teach people what was in there and the value of that particular habitat. After the fire occurred, the habitat was not as pristine as it once was, so that's when the Canyoneers began to expand to do walks throughout the whole county, which we do now. We do offer free public walks every single weekend, and that is between September and June. You can find the free public walks by going onto the website for the San Diego Natural History Museum or picking up a brochure. No reservations required. Just show up. We break up into small groups, and the whole idea of a Canyoneer walk is not to hurry up to get there and hurry up to get back. It's to walk slowly, to look around, to investigate, to smell, to see
right.
what the interaction is in the habitat with the surrounding plants and species.
So to engage all your senses.
Absolutely. And you asked about the connection to the exhibition, the Costa Cactus Southern California. That exhibition was created to basically get the county and the folks in the county to be aware of the habitats that are found here in the county. But more important than that, to understand that San Diego is a biological hot zone. It's a biodiversity hot zone. There are 32 places in the world that are hotspots, and to be a hotspot means that you have incredible diversity in an area, but you have threatened species or species that have disappeared. And because of that, you want to keep an eye and watch these areas very carefully. And because San Diego is a hotspot, we want people to be aware of what is out here. We want them to be become more conscious of conservation for this area. And so that was part of what the exhibit is all about. So you can go to the exhibit, you can learn about the habitats, learn why San Diego is a hotspot, and then you can take the field guide, which is actually a complement to this exhibition. And this is your field guide to get into the field to actually see what's out there. So it complements the exhibition. One is an actual museum experience. The other one is a field experience.
And do you think this will help conservation efforts?
We certainly hope so. It's, you know, the museum and also my publication house believe very strongly in what a Senegalese conservationist, Baba Douim, has said. And what he has said is, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand. And we will understand only what we are taught. And so that's what the exhibition is about. That's what this book is about. It's about teaching folks in San Diego County what is special about this county. And once you learn and get excited about it, you're going to have a personal feeling for it, and you're going to want to protect it and lead to taking care of these special areas, which as our county grows and more people move into it, we want to make sure these particular areas are protected.
Wonderful. I can't wait to dig into this book. One last question. What is your favorite trail?
Well, I'm known as a desert person, so obviously my favorite trails are all in the Anzabrego Desert State Park area. And those trails kind of vary for me depending on my moods. If I want a kind of a closed-in experience, I like to go into the slot canyons. Those are kind of fun because they're magical, especially with the light changes. If I want to have spectacular views, I might want to go up on Whale Peak and kind of take a look at the views around there. Split Mountain is always great for geology. Coyote Canyon is wonderful because it has the longest running stream in San Diego County. It always has water. Mountain Palm Canyon is wonderful. Mountain Palm Springs, rather. It has just wonderful palm trees that are in there. And then plus if you go up to Torote Bowl, there's the very rare elephant tree and the spectacular view of the Vallecito Badlands. So there's many special places in the Anzabrego Desert. Fonts Point, a lot of people like to go out there and take a look at that spectacular view, especially at sunset, as you look out over the Borrego Badlands. But it's a very special place. So for me, I'm happy almost anywhere in the desert.
And have you always been a desert person?
Well, not really. It's interesting that you should ask that because this happens to be my 50th anniversary of my introduction to Anzabrego State Park. I had actually met my husband at a mountaineering club at UCLA when we always went backpacking the Sierras. And when he became a helicopter pilot with the Navy, we were stationed in San Diego, and he would fly over the desert on training missions and said, "Hey, we need to go out and check out that place." And I said, "Come on, get real. This is a desert. There's nothing there. That's
right.
Why it's a desert." And so we had a few arguments back and forth because he would say, "Come on, we really need to check it out." And I finally said, "Look, if I go one time out there, would you just quit bugging me?" So we went. I had a fantastic experience. It was spring. It was Painted Gorge out on Coyote Mountains. The following week, he said, "Okay, let's go to the Sierras." And I said, "Can we go back to the desert?"
No,
and I've been going ever since. My master's thesis was done on it, and several books have been done on the desert. And I always am anxious to get back to the desert.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Our time is up, but it's been wonderful talking to you, Diana.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
For more information on Coast to Cactus, please visit sunbeltpublications.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Six of East County Magazine's reporters are on the winner's list in the San Diego Press Club's Excellence in Journalism Awards. Congratulations to our reporters Jonathan Getz, Rebecca Jeffress-Williamson, Paul Cruz, Mimi Pollack, Rachel Williams, and editor Miriam Raftery. Now, Press Club lists only the names of winners, so we don't yet know what exactly won, or the placements. Also, a couple of these writers entered works for more than one media outlet, but it's clear that East County Magazine will once again have multiple winning entries, boosting our total of 101 journalism awards even higher. Our entries this year spanned a broad variety of topics, including our coverage of the Alfred Olongo shooting, efforts to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center, the aftermath of the border fire, Syrian refugees in East County, wildlife rescue organizations, collapse of a wind turbine in Ocotillo, ethics issues involving local elected officials in both political parties, and First Amendment freedoms. The awards gala will be held on October 24th at the Jacobs Center. Good luck to all of our entrants. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Green Scene Report. Governor Jerry Brown has signed Senate Bill 214, legislation authored by San Diego State Senator Tony Atkins, to strengthen the San Diego River Conservancy's ability to protect and enhance historic, cultural, and natural resources along the 52-mile San Diego River. The measure also gives local tribes a voice in decisions involving the San Diego River watershed. East County's State Senator Joel Anderson voted against the bill, while the rest of the San Diego County delegation, Republicans and Democrats, voted in favor of the landmark bill to enhance recreation, protect and restore the environment along the river. Anderson has a history of taking hefty contributions from development interests. SB 214 builds upon an earlier measure authored by Atkins in 2015 that made the San Diego River Conservancy a permanent entity. SB 214 adds representation from the City of Santee and the Kumeyaay Diaguino Land Conservancy to the San Diego River Conservancy's Board of Directors. It also provides the Conservancy with greater ability to enter into joint power agreements. Senator Atkins says, "The San Diego River is a rural and urban waterway running from Julian to Ocean Beach that remains undiscovered by many local residents and visitors alike. We must continue to enhance public access to the river and protect its entire 440-square-mile watershed." She adds, SB 214 adds new tools to the toolbox and bolsters efforts along the eastern portions of the river by bringing to the table our partners from Santee and tribal reservation land. The San Diego River Conservancy is also slated to receive $12 million from a major parks and water bond that will be placed on the June statewide ballot next year, pending the governor's signature on SB 5, which passed the legislature earlier this month. Meanwhile, still on Governor Brown's desk is SB 667, another bill backed by Atkins that aims to improve California's waterways. That measure would create a riparian stewardship program to provide technical assistance with planning, design, construction, and project evaluation to organizations seeking to enhance or restore waterways in their communities, reduce flood risk, improve habitat or public access. SB 667 appropriates no money, however, it would be a candidate for funding under the Parks Bond.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykle, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.